Hello and welcome to Psychic Teachers. I'm your host, Deb Bowen.
And I'm Samantha Fay.
And we are just delighted and honored that you have joined us. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a show that Samantha and I have been wanting to do for a long time. It's taken us a while to pull all of our research together, and we're really excited about talking about mythical beasts. Oh, my. But before we do that, of course, we have a Crystal of the Week and a real animal of the week, although these might be not mythical, but we'll get to that. And so we have a couple of things to do before we get started. Samantha, would you like to start with the crystal?
No, you go ahead. I want to hear about the seal you're doing, because that sounds really, really fascinating considering our topic.
Well, it is, and because of our topic and because of one of the mythical beings I'm going to be talking about, it led me to realize that I've never talked about seals. And so I did a lot of research on seals and a lot of different cultures and different researchers and psychics have differing perspectives on what seal energy is really all about. And, of course, know that there are lots of different kinds of seals, so I'm just really painting a broad brush stroke here. But all of the sources that I investigated had a couple of common threads, and one was that seals remind us to be joyful. They really are one of the playmates of the universe. Seals teach us to have a sense of humor. Seals teach us to take ourselves lightly. Seal people, I don't know that I'm a seal person, but seal people are those folks. One of the websites I looked at said seal people are the grown-ups who blow bubbles at parties. And as you know, Samantha, I keep a little container of bubbles in my car to blow them out the window sitting at traffic lights. I don't hear that. I mean, you know that about me. So they are also very uncaring about people laughing at them and what people think when they bubble over with this joyous energy. So seals teach us to play, to have fun in our lives. Seals also teach us to be good partners and to have meaningful and kind relationships. And so they teach us that whatever earth suit you are born into, whatever configuration of relationships you might have in your life, to honor those relationships with integrity and honesty and joyfulness. So seals teach us about that as well. They also teach us to find a balance of opposites, to look for energy that may be different from ours so that we can learn and grow from other beings around us. So I just was fascinated with reading some of the great things about seals. So that's just a little bit to maybe whet folks' appetite about the energy of seals.
So if people are drawn to seals or they keep seeing like a documentary on seals and then they see seals in the news, do you think it's a message to add more play to your life?
Absolutely. One place I read suggested that when you want to connect with seal energy or seal energy tries to connect with you, to use all of your senses because, of course, you know, seals are water creatures, so they're mammals, so they have both that mammal and water energy, and listen to the songs and sounds that seals make and, you know, find some pictures of them. But they respond to you if you want to connect with them by chanting. So if you want to chant and sing, that will help you connect to seal energy. So will meditation about and around water, including, you know, you can just go to the bathtub or a swimming pool or, you know, run in the shower. But you can also connect with them during yoga and tai chi, slow, fluid kind of exercises. Will also help you connect to seal energy.
Very, very nice.
Yes, there you go.
Okay, well, the stone I chose, since we're going to be talking about dragons and mermaids and gnomes and selkies and unicorns, I decided to talk about Septarian dragon egg, which is a really cool stone I started working with about a year ago. It looks like a dragon egg. Most of the ones that you buy, they're egg-shaped, and on the bottom looks like an egg. It's got the brown with the darker brown lines, like you would think of a dragon egg. And then the inside is this lovely brown aragonite, usually Bhatri oil shape, or you might, you know, just it looks like an egg cut in half. It's super cool. You've got to Google them if you don't know what I'm talking about. These dragon eggs were formed over 50 million years ago by volcanic eruptions. So they have a huge, powerful energy to them. They are made of calcite, aragonite, and sometimes chalcedony or barite. So they do have properties of those stones in them as well. If you think about what a dragon does, what does a dragon do? A dragon protects treasure. A dragon guards the princess. So dragon eggs are very protective stones. They help to banish nightmares and block psychic attack, and they work to bring your energy into a state of protection. They help us get in touch with the magic inside of us. And because dragons are the guardians of treasure, working with Septarian dragon egg helps to increase your prosperity and financial abundance as well. It's strongly connected to the Devic kingdom. It connects with the energy of Mother Earth. They are often called shaman stones. Because they are eggs and they bring up a reminder of birth, meditating with Septarian dragon egg helps you get in touch with your birth plan so that you can remember why you are here and what it is you are supposed to be doing. It helps you view a dramatic situation you might be going through from a higher perspective. It helps you get along with people through a dramatic situation. It helps to reveal the truth of a situation and the lessons you're supposed to learn from a situation. So they're very powerful stones. I got mine about a year ago at Mystic Elements, our local store that we always recommend. And mine is big. Like it fits in the palm of my hand, but it's bigger than the palm of my hand. And I think mine was like $40. So I think that's a really good price for a pretty large stone.
They're beautiful. They're lovely stones.
Yeah.
And our friend Susan also got one a while back, and she has really enjoyed working with the energy of that stone. And you know, I think sometimes we discount those stones that are not, you know, bright and shiny, and this one isn't, but it sure is a powerhouse of a stone, isn't it?
It is, and you know, it's so funny because about 2 years ago, I think, you and I were at a store we love in South Carolina, and I saw that ugly little brownstone sitting at the counter with all the dust on it, remember?
I did.
And I bought that thing, and I didn't even know what it was. It was just solid brown. It's that poor thing. I'm looking at it right now. I shouldn't say it. And it's little presents, but it's just not the prettiest thing. And I just felt like I had to adopt this little stone and bring it home, and it turns out that it's a Septarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied about what Septarian means, and I thought that was really cool. And then I'm in Mystic Elements, and the label said dragon's eggs. And I love studying about dragons, and I thought I just had to get it because it was a dragon egg. I thought that is so cool. So I bought it, brought it home, found out it's a Septarian. Then I'm in Nashville at this crystal store, and I see these little stones. They look like eyes. I'm not kidding you. And the tag said eye nodules. And I thought, oh, that is so cool. That would be really great to put in a crystal grid. You know, if I'm like trying to look out for something or get to the heart of something, I'd like to have those two little eyes. So I bring those home. I Google eye nodules. They're called Septarian eye nodules.
And, of course, Septarian has to do with snake and
mm-hmm.
you know, cold-blooded
transformation.
Energy.
Yeah.
Fun. Cool.
So. It's neat to look at the stones that are drawn to you and that you are drawn to and to draw the connection between them.
You know, and sometimes it's not what you think.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know.
So
yeah.
Deb and I came up with this show because I don't even know how I mentioned something about dragons. And Deb said, well, you know, dragons are in the Bible. And I said, shut up, they are not. And you
unicorns.
Said, yes, they are. What?
Unicorns are in the Bible.
Oh, unicorns are in the Bible. That's right. That's right. So that's how we started talking about doing research for this whole show about how these quote-unquote mythical beings are everywhere in our history, in our legend, in our lore, and even in our Bible.
Right. I know.
Where would you like to start?
I think you were going to start with gnomes.
Oh, sure. I can start. Yeah. Yeah, so one of the mythical creatures that I research are gnomes, and this is something I feel like I know a bit about fairies and mermaids and whatnot, but gnomes I've never really tried to research. I think of them as little garden gnomes, but when I was doing the research, it turns out that almost every single country believes in gnomes. There are different names for them in Germany, Finland, Denmark, Sweden, England, Iceland, Poland, Bulgaria, Albania, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia. Chinese myths have gnomes. The continents of Africa and Australia have words for gnomes. So this is a worldwide phenomenon, which I found pretty interesting. Most of the legend and lore does go back to Scandinavian and Norse cultures. There are forest gnomes and garden gnomes. There are house gnomes and little gnomes that are connected to farms. In appearance, they usually are described as being about a foot tall. They tend to wear long hats that make them appear taller. They have these pigeon-shaped toes that help them to run very, very fast. Their job is to guard animals and to guard gems and mines and things. But mainly they're known to guard animals, except cats. They do not like cats. Gnomes have been known to help injured animals and free animals caught in traps. They are said to live in hilly meadows or rocky woodlands or in the earth itself. Some legends have them living in trees, but most of the stories and research I did have them living underground. They are 7 times stronger than us and can run up to 35 miles per hour. They also have excellent vision. Gnomes love crystals. They are known to guard mines and treasures. They are connected to the element earth. Because of their love for animals, they are vegetarian. They tend to eat nuts and fruits, berries, vegetables, and they are said to drink fermented honey. What's interesting is one of our first references to gnomes comes from a 16th century Swedish alchemist named Paracelsus. Alchemists used gnomes in their writing. As we know, alchemists used a lot of symbols and put hidden messages into symbols, and they used gnomes to represent earth. Salamanders represented fire, undines represented water, and sylphs represented air. But it was gnomes that represented earth, and most people agree that Paracelsus, the 16th century alchemist, was the first to do so. The word gnome comes from the Latin gnomus, which means earth dweller. Now, we do see gnomes popping up in many stories and fairy tales. Of course, the more present Harry Potter mentions gnomes, Chronicles of Narnia. They are in The Wizard of Oz. Tolkien writes about them in several different stories and of course, his famous series. Alexander Pope has a story from centuries ago called The Rape of the Lock, which depicts the gnomes as beings that would watch over women who were in danger of being attacked by predators. There's an old book, an old story that the Brothers Grimm rewrote called The Three Little Men in the Wood. They also wrote one called The Gnome. And then Rumpelstiltskin, of course, is a little gnome. Atlanta, Savannah, and Cleveland, Ohio have gnome parades. Did you know that, Deb?
I did not.
Yeah, me neither. Whole parades. Now, one of the things that I love to do, and one of the things I have fantasies about doing when I have more time on my hands, is researching the common thread that runs through all of these myths, you know, and really, my daughter actually just got a book that does just that. I'll have to it's a yellow, mustardy yellow cover. I can't remember the title right now. But there's a book that takes every single myth and shows you how all the myths throughout the world have that myth, from the creation to the flood to so on. But I love looking at the connection not only between myths but between legends and lores, and seeing, you know, where did these start? How do they spread? Why are they connected? What is the true message in this story of this mythological creature? There is an Egyptian god named Geb, G-E-B, who is short and is called the god of the earth, which I thought was interesting. There's an Indian god named Kubera, K-U-B-E-R-A, who is described as being very short in stature, and he is the god who guards earth's treasures. He's also said to be the lord of wealth and the chief of evil spirits. So you'll find lots of stories about gnomes where they're super helpful, and then you'll find lots of stories about gnomes where they're super mean, kind of like the leprechauns of Ireland. One story tells that gnomes gather sunlight and spin it into gold, and then they gather moonlight and spin it into silver. Isn't that a lovely thought?
Indeed.
And there's
it is.
A little, there's a poem from one of those stories that says, "Sunlight so bright, we hold and we mold. Down under the ground, we turn it into gold. When the full moon spills out her lovely light, we turn it to silver, so pure and so bright. The stars twinkle deep in the sky overhead. Their light makes the jewels blue, yellow, and red." So because gnomes are supposedly gatherers of, you know, earth's treasures in form of mines and minerals and crystals, I just like that idea that they spin sunlight into gold and moonlight into silver. Now, a lot of the research I did talked about gnomes and dwarves interchangeably. Have you thought about them as being interchangeable, Deb?
No. I see them as very separate, with very separate tasks.
Me too. And some of the research I did shows them as being very separate, and some of them use them interchangeably, like gnomes and dwarves, or dwarves and elves and gnomes, all kind of together. Dwarves, from what I researched, tend to be a little bit kinder than gnomes to humans. Gnomes are more about animals and the earth. They don't really have a lot to do with us, whereas dwarves tend to have more of a connection to humans. The dwarf stories tend to originate in mythology, especially Norse mythology. There's stories about them creating treasures for the gods, like the famous one where they created Thor's hammer. Dwarves are said to be very wise and are said to be favored by the gods, who bestowed wisdom on them. They're associated with smithing, mining, and crafting. They're said to be about 18 inches tall. They're usually depicted as old men with beards, and they are known to be friendly to humans. Think of the dwarves who helped the shoemaker, or Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. They love to live in the forest and the mountains. What's interesting is if you look at early writings about dwarves, they weren't always described as small. That kind of came in more later writings. They were almost seen as demigods, granting wishes and performing magic. They're said to guard the doorways into mountains, or some believe they guard the doorways between the worlds. In all of the stories about gnomes and dwarves, there's very few females mentioned. It's mainly the men that are mentioned. And I don't know if that's from a patriarchal society or what, but nevertheless, that's the way it seems to be. Dwarves and gnomes are said to reward people who are nice and help them, and punish people who are mean. They are said to be clairvoyant and can make themselves invisible. There's a lot of stories, even modern day stories, of people who are still claiming to see dwarves and gnomes. And in most of the modern day stories I read, they will talk about seeing this, you know, this magical being, and then seeing it disappear right in front of their eyes. In China, there's a god of examinations. Don't you love that? Did you know there was a god in charge of test taking?
I did not.
And he is described as a smart but ugly dwarf. and he is a deity that scholars pray to.
Interesting.
So I thought, I thought that was really cool. There's this dwarf or gnome or elf. He's described as all three, and he's described all in so many different stories. I can't even name them all. His name is Oberon, O-B-E-R-O-N. The name originates from a 15th century French poem, but you're probably saying, no, no, Samantha, he's the consort to the Queen of Fairies in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Yes, that's true. But history says that the name originates from this 15th century French poem. Oberon, like I said, is described as a dwarf. He's also described as the king of the elves. Sometimes he's called the king of the fairies, king of the dwarves, king of the gnomes. So he's all different words. He is a magician. He guards treasures. One story has him as the child of Morgan Le Fay and Julius Caesar. Now tell me what story this reminds you all of. It was said that when he was born, there was one fairy who wasn't invited to his christening. And so she cursed him to stop growing at the age of three. But then she felt bad and gave him incredible beauty in return. The other fairies also felt bad for him, and so they granted him the gift of clairvoyance, the ability to go wherever he wanted by wishing, the ability to tame any creature, and to never age or look old. And he also was given the gift to build a castle with a word. Aren't those super cool gifts to have?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how we get the story of Sleeping Beauty.
Right.
He is also said to have a magical cup. And a lot of people have called this the Holy Grail cup. But like I said, he pops up over and over and over again in myths throughout the cultures and the ages. And, you know, obviously in Shakespeare's work as well. So the writings about these gnomes and dwarves and elves go so far back, you can't even, you know, it goes back to the origination of writing, which is pretty, pretty cool. There's stories about, you know, evil dwarfs. There's Disney is actually taking the story of Snow White and Rose Red and turning it into a movie, my girls told me. I didn't even know Snow White had a sister named Rose Red. Did you know that?
Yes.
Okay, I did not know that, and that's just really cool. So she's Snow White and she's Rose Red, and there's a story of the two of them. They go into this woods, and before they go into the woods, there's this beautiful prince, and he was very mean to an evil dwarf, and so the evil dwarf turned him into a bear and steals the prince's treasure, all of his money. And the two sisters meet this bear and take care of this bear prince. They rescue the evil dwarf three times, but he's always ungrateful. Finally, the bear prince kills the dwarf, and the spell is broken, and he gets his treasure back. Nothing in that story makes sense to me, Deb. If you were a tiny, tiny, tiny dwarf, and you wanted to punish a prince and steal his treasure, would you turn him into a great big bear? I mean, if they're supposed to be wise, right? I'd turn him into, like, a flea.
You need to read the story some more, I think. Maybe there's some hidden meaning we don't get yet.
I don't know.
Is there any more for that?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to talk about Iceland because I found some pretty cool stuff with Iceland's belief on gnomes and elves. They have a name for it called Huldufólk, and if anyone is from Iceland, I know I mispronounced that, and I apologize. It's spelled Huldufólk, and it means hidden people. Iceland is one of the most literate countries in the world. Isn't that a cool little fact?
Yeah.
A 1998 survey showed that 54% of Icelanders believe in elves, to the point where, like, construction has stopped on several occasions. You guys can research on the internet where they have, like,
moved boulders.
They've
moved roads.
Yeah. Where these elves and gnomes live. It's so cool.
It is cool.
Iceland has a 5-page standard reply they give out to people who have questions about building in elfin territory.
I love that.
In 2010, a member of parliament named Arne Johnson slid on ice, flipped his SUV over, and walked away without a scratch. He later said a group of elves living in a boulder nearby, the accident helped to save his life. Now, obviously, we have elves connected to, you know, Santa Claus and living in this really, really snowy, always cold area that could be like Iceland. And we get the elves helping out Santa and being focused on bringing kids, you know, a Merry Christmas, which is interesting. But even in Australia, they have a word for little people called woodaji. It's spelled W-O-O-D-A-R-J-E-E. They are described as mischievous and often mean little people. One man claimed to see a woodaji in Perth when he was 6 years old. He says he saw a small man about 13 inches tall wearing just a loincloth. He said the man threw a spear at him, and then the man and the spear disappeared in front of his eyes. Another man very recently in Canada said that he awoke one night to see six or seven little men in his room who asked him about the things in his room and then disappeared. In August of 2004, a 10-year-old girl in Pennsylvania here in the States was camping with her family. She followed the sound of beautiful music to a clearing in the woods where she saw a young boy, very, very small, sitting on a stump playing a woodland instrument. He had pointed ears. He asked her to play with him, but she said she had to go back to her family. When she got back to her family, she felt bad for not playing with the little boy with the pointed ears. And so she went back two more times and never saw him. But each time she would leave an apple on the stump where he had first appeared, the tree stump. And both times when she went back, a very smooth stone was in its place of the apple. So you hear stories like this that appear all over the world. In Central America, they're called Wendis, W-E-N-D-I-S. The First People have a story about Pukwudgies. Paranormal State did a whole episode on Pukwudgies. They're pretty spooky. They're mainly in Massachusetts from what I've researched. And then obviously in Ireland, they are leprechauns. So we have stories of these little people all over the world. And I know that the Vikings like conquered and traveled everywhere. And, you know, maybe a lot of this spread that way. But a lot of these stories predate the Vikings. And I just think it's really cool that before we had the capacity to travel and the way in which, you know, the ancient Greeks and the Vikings later could, we still have these stories popping up in countries that were not communicating.
Wow. Whew. We're not going to get to all of our information today. You realize that?
No.
That's all right. We'll just add on another show with some of this because I've got a lot to talk about Silky. So we'll get
okay,
to some of
it. Okay, go ahead. I'm done.
Wait, we're at the halfway point. So tell folks about our sponsor.
Okay, sure. So we are sponsored by Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/psychicteachers, you can try Audible free for 1 month. And remember, if you download a book, and God forbid you download a book I recommend and then you hate it, don't worry. You just email Audible and say, I didn't like that book or I hated the narrator's voice, and you get another free credit for that month. So it's very, very risk-free. This week, I am recommending American Monsters by Linda Godfrey. The full title is American Monsters, A History of Monster Lore, Legends, and Sightings in America. She's a really good writer. She got her fame writing about the Beast of Bray Road, so I think you guys will enjoy that. But if you just go to Audible and you Google, like, mysterious stories, there's so many cool things on there. There's Mysteries of the South, Mysterious New England, History of Strange Creatures. So there's lots of cool stuff on Audible. But I'm recommending American Monsters this week by Linda Godfrey.
Wonderful. Thanks. And then we need to tell folks, we need to tell folks to please like us on our Facebook page and comment and share our post. We really appreciate interacting with you on our Facebook page. Please make a comment on iTunes, on our iTunes page. That helps boost our listenership and recommendations from iTunes about our podcast. So we really appreciate that. And I know I've got some things coming up in terms of some classes that I'm planning and putting my curriculum together for the fall. So watch our Facebook page and my website for that. And I know you've got some things happening too, Samantha.
Yes, yes, we have. We're both offering some really cool classes, telecourses, and workshops online. So, yeah, you can follow us on Facebook or go to our individual websites, SamanthaFay.com, DebBowen.com. I'm also really trying to add a lot of different bracelets to my website because I keep being shown in meditation that we're being guided and called right now to work more with crystals, and a lot of people aren't comfortable with holding them for meditation or figuring out where to place them on their body or what to do with them, and that wearing them as jewelry is a great introduction. So I'm really trying hard to add a lot more bracelets with some really good crystals, beads on there. So check out my website for that information and my Etsy store.
There you go. And I am still getting messages from Mary Magdalene. I know some of you have written me and asked me about that. I am, and as they come in and I begin to ask her to her, whoever she may be really, to help me put some thoughts together as to how to best convey that information, look for updates from those meditations in my blog as well. So thank you all so much for that.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, when I was a teenager, many, many, many years ago in a land far away, one of my very favorite musicians then and still is today, Joan Baez. And in her early days of recording, Joan recorded old traditional ballads from Celtic lands and some other places as well. One of the songs that she recorded early on in her career, and I'm talking early 60s, was a song entitled The Silky of Sul Skeri. And the song tells the legend of this being who in the sea is a seal. And in this version of the story, when he comes to land, he sheds his seal skin and becomes a man. And falls in love, of course, with a wonderful woman who lives by the sea. And it ends, the song ends very tragically. They have a child, and there is a prediction in the song that the child will grow up to be a very good marksman, and the first arrow that he shoots will kill his father. And so it's an amazing legend. And so that led me to doing lots of research on this sea being, creature, thing called a silky. It's spelled many different ways. I think the most common spelling is S-E-L-K-I. The legend of the silky is shifts and changes. It's common in Irish and Scottish and Icelandic folklore. Particularly, you'll hear a lot of it in Scotland and Ireland. The word derives from a Scottish word that means seal. In Gaelic stories, there were specific terms related to silky to differentiate them from the notion of mermaids, which, of course, also have those same similar characteristics, but they're different. They have different energies and do different things. Some years later, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, in her wonderful book, The Women Who Run with Wolves, Women Who Run with the Wolves, did a whole beautiful chapter on the Silkie legend, but this time from the female Silkie's perspective. And that story, that version of the story that Clarissa wrote, changed my life. There was, I had a very deep connection to that story in several ways. And I'm going to paraphrase the story for you just a little bit here because I love it so much. But in this legend, it is a female silky who comes ashore. And she takes off her seal skin and becomes this beautiful woman. She tosses it aside, and she's just laying on a rock, kind of sunning herself and exploring and feeling what it means to be human. And a fisherman steals her seal skin. And in the legend, she is then duty-bound to stay with him for 7 years and a day as his wife, which she does, and they have a child. And as the 7 years and a day approach, she is able to find where he has hidden her seal skin. And even though she loved him, she certainly loved her child. The call of being who she really was so strong that she puts on that seal skin and she dives back into the water. Now, some legends have her taking her child with her for brief periods of time for him able to visit her for time, but he is bound basically to be on land. And sometimes in other legends, versions of the legend, she's just gone. But the sentence that this female Silky says as she dons her sealskin to become herself again after 7 years and a day is, "When it's time, it's time." And that very short little sentence is an extremely powerful sentence if you can think about how that might play out in your own lives and in decisions that you may be making or changes or transitions going on in your own life. So that's one of my favorite versions of that story. We're not real sure where the legends originate. One theory is that it became the physical characteristics of the Silky became a way to minimize and to help children who were born with abnormalities to deal with them. When sometimes, of course, those abnormalities many, many years ago were blamed on the fairies. And so sometimes, for example, if you saw abnormal growth on skin, or webbed fingers with children, for example, perhaps with Down syndrome, those were explained away by the idea that this child might be connected to Silky energy. Scottish folklorist David McRitchie said that early settlers in Scotland probably encountered and even married women who were misidentified as Silkies because of their sealskin kayaking clothing, women who had kayaked over from Finland, for example. Other traditions say that Silky may have originated as a misinterpreted sighting of Inuit men from the Davis Straits because they wore animal skins and were able to be so buoyant in their crafts on the water. Another belief is that shipwrecked Spaniards were washed ashore in these northern countries and that their jet black hair resembled seals. Sometimes they were said to be the supernatural forms of a kind of ghost of souls of people who had drowned. So we really don't know where the legend comes from, but just as Samantha talked about with gnomes, this is a pervasive concept in many of those northern countries in the Celtic and Scandinavian countries. So it's all over the place. What makes perhaps them different from mermaids is that while a mermaid is a mermaid, these silkies change forms. Mermaids don't in most of the legends. I don't often recommend movies, as you all know, but one of my very favorite movies in the whole world is The Secret of Roan Inish, and that's R-O-A-N, and the second word is Inish, I-N-I-S-H. It's a 1994 interpretation of a novel entitled Secrets of the Ron Mor Skiri by Rosalie K. Fry. And it's about a young girl who discovers a connection in her family to Silky ancestry. And I just love that. And I know, Samantha, there's a an animated movie that you like a whole lot connected to Silky legends. Could you tell me?
Yes. I'm not sure of the name of it. I'll look it up. I just love the artwork. Oh, and it was done in Ireland, and it's still on demand. I just can't remember the title. I'm looking it up. Song of the Sea.
Oh, okay. There you go. Song of the Sea.
Song of the Sea.
Mm-hmm. So
it's just Google Song of the Sea and just click through the illustrations. There's even like a whole Pinterest site dedicated to just the beautiful illustrations.
I've seen the movie, and it is lovely. I mean, the artwork is just marvelous. But I love this legend, and I love the idea of transformation that Selkies teach us, because they do. They teach us about what is home, and in fact, I think that's the title of the chapter. In Running with Women Who Run with the Wolves is about finding home and finding home within ourselves, not just in terms of a place, but metaphorically finding home. And that Silky energy helps us to connect with that. So there you go.
What do you think it's about too with the shedding of the skin? Do you think it's kind of like what we were talking about in another show about, you know, being your authentic self and owning who you are?
Absolutely. And that no matter how far away from that you get, you gotta go back to being who you really are. As everybody who listens to the show knows, I grew up on an island, and that was home. And so much of who I am and my identity was connected to living on that island and being able to walk on that beach. And for a variety of reasons and for a lot of years, I lived 10 miles or so from that ocean. And I know that that does not seem like a long ways. I know it doesn't. But it was, both physically and metaphorically for me for many years. And now that I'm older, you've heard me say this, Samantha, I had to go home. And so I have gone back to living with 1,000 steps from the high tide line. And it's coming home for me. And so the Silky story for me is at this point in my life a really poignant, important lesson for me. It was one of the
when it's time, it's time.
When it's time, it's time. And that's exactly where I've been. Yeah. So thank you. There we go. I think we have time for one more. Would you like to do another one of yours?
No, I'll save mine. You do, because you've got so many cool notes. I want to hear one of yours.
Okay. All right. So let me read you this. This is from the King James Version of the Bible, and I am reading the book of Numbers, chapter 23, verse 22. God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Deuteronomy 33:17. His glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Psalms 22:21. Save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorn. Job 39:9. Will the unicorn be willing to serve thee, or abide by thy crib? And it goes, Isaiah, let me just read one more. Isaiah 34:7. And the unicorns shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls. And their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fairness. And that's that's just some of the mentions of unicorns. So then, of course, you have to go to the websites and the research that debunks what I just read to you. Because only in the King James Version is the word unicorn mentioned. As the Bible was translated into other versions over time, that unicorn word was taken out. Many folks believe that what was being described, rather than a unicorn, was some other kind of one-horned, real, quote, real animal. And most often the research I looked at described it as rhinoceros, as a rhinoceros. And I don't know that there were rhinoceri, I think that's the plural, in what is now Israel. I don't know that there were, but, you know, who knows? I may be wrong. So anyway, I just find that that whole connection to a mythological being in the Bible is an interesting, and only in the Old Testament, by the way, not the New Testament. I find that just an interesting kind of thing to ponder, that we really don't know. Another theory is that it represented any kind of one-horned being, not just a rhinoceros. So who knows? However, way older than biblical mentions of the unicorn are others, way much older than that. They're not found, interestingly, in Greek mythology. You don't see unicorns in Greek mythology, but in Greek accounts of natural history. Natural historians in Greece believed that unicorns were very real. They thought that they came from India, which was a distant and fabulous place for them. They were often described as being white, red, or black. Aristotle said that he mentions two one-horned animals, the oryx, which is a kind of antelope, and then I've lost the other one. Pliny, the elder, mentions the oryx and an Indian ox, or perhaps a rhinoceros, as one-horned beast. But there's a ton of mentions of the unicorn in Greek history, not in Greek mythology, but there was a belief that these were very real beings. And then you will see in Ethiopia, in Alexandria, some mention of unicorns as well. Again, not sure what it really might have been, but again, another culture where there is a description and mention of unicorns. And then, of course, during the Middle Ages, we find that blossoming of the unicorn legend, particularly connected to the tapestries, which I'm trying to find my notes on the tapestries here, but they're the idea of purity. Unicorns, remember, in Middle Age mythology, maintains that unicorns can only be captured by a pure maiden as she sits quietly, and that the unicorn will come to her. They're very skittish of other people, and that they represent, in some legends, the Virgin Mary. In others, they represent Jesus and the pain and passion of his life. So there's a big connection with unicorns and Christianity and mythology. If you've ever been to the Metropolitan and seen the unicorn tapestries, have you done that, Samantha? Have you seen those?
Oh, yes. They're beautiful.
Aren't they amazing? What, just as having been a weaver at one point in my life, I'm just amazed and fascinated by the unicorn tapestries, but also by the legends that come with them. And again, you see them, particularly in the Middle Ages, just blossoming in many different cultures. In 13th century France, there was a notion of lovers attracted only to virgins and represented by the unicorn. In Italy, you will see a similar kind of thing. In Denmark, I love this. The throne chair of Denmark is made of, quote, unicorn horns, most certainly narwhal tusk. And if you all know, narwhal are the whales with the big long horn on their heads. And they've used it in Denmark, they use the same material for ceremonial cups because it believed that unicorns' horns neutralized poison. I found that interesting. Marco Polo described them as scarcely smaller than elephants. They have the hair of a buffalo and feet like an elephant. They have a single large black horn in the middle of the forehead. They have a head like a wild boar. They spend their time by preference wallowing in mud and slime. They are very ugly brutes to look at. They are not at all such as we describe them when we relate them as they let themselves be captured by virgins, but clean contrary to our notions. It's clear that, of course, Marco Polo was really describing a rhinoceros as opposed to a unicorn. So in the tapestry hangings, there are, I think there are three or four tapestries in that series. The Hunt of the Unicorn is probably the most famous of them, and that's one of the ones that's hanging in the cloisters at the Met. And you see this unicorn in captivity, just kind of lying on the ground in this enclosed fence area. And there's another one with a unicorn with his head in the lap of a virgin. The unicorn is used in so many coats of arms around the world, including, of course, you know, Britain, Scotland, Sweden, Germany. Lots of different coats of arms use this unicorn as a symbol. So why are we so taken with this? And I could go on and on. I mean, Chinese legends, you see them in almost every culture. What is it about this being that we are so taken with it that even in the face of, like, Marco Polo's description, clearly it's not a unicorn, clearly it's a rhinoceros. Why this mythical being, maybe above all others, resonates so deeply within us? Do you have thoughts on that, Samantha?
Well, I'd like to think that we are connected and entranced by the unicorn because it represents, you know, hope and uniqueness and magical things. But I think it comes back to our weird fascination with sex and virginity, to be honest with you.
I should have known you would go there, but there we go.
But I mean, really, I do. I mean, look, we still have people killing people all over the world for the hope of 72 virgins. Like, it's weird. People are so obsessed with that. And I think it comes back to that, because you cannot read a unicorn legend without the myth of only appearing to a virgin.
Certainly, at least since medieval times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is true. Absolutely true.
What do you think is the fascination?
Well, I don't disagree with you, but I wonder if it also has to do with that, that notion of that search for the virgin is also about finding something that is pure and unsullied and
kind
and gentle, you know. You never hear of a unicorn goring anybody with that one horn. You never hear that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not.
But even the one horn is phallic. Sorry. The whole thing is just weird to me.
Well, it is. It absolutely is. You know, and there are other beings. There are other real, quote, real beings that have one horn in addition to the rhinoceros.
Right.
The narwhals are fascinating whales if you aren't familiar with them. But yes, it is phallic. Certainly it is. Certainly it is. But it's also white. You know, in Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling gives unicorn foals the color gold, and that they turn white as they get older. and that their the hair from their tails has healing properties, not from their horn, but from their tails. And I just kind of like the way she treats that, the energy of the unicorn. But again, it's magical, and its purity is the ultimate aspects of the unicorn that she focuses on.
You know, I took my girls to see Despicable Me 3, and one of the subplots of that little cartoon story is the little girl is looking for a unicorn, and she finds a one-horned goat, and nobody has the heart to tell her it's not a unicorn. So she just brings home this one-horned unicorn. Anyway, so my daughters and I were talking about Harry Potter and all of that, and I said to the girls, I said, think about it. There is a woman alive on this earth in England or Scotland right now who wrote a book that your kids, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will be talking about probably 300 years from now. Isn't that so neat to think about? Like, we're talking about all these legends and, like, Shakespeare's, you know, Midsummer's Night Dream. I think Harry Potter's going to be like that, don't you?
I certainly hope so.
Me too. Anyway, I don't want to get off that topic, but I do want to get off topic for one quick second. I had, like, a total nerd moment the other night, and I was watching C-SPAN. C-SPAN actually has started videoing or filming professors giving lectures, you know, to different colleges at, like, Harvard and Emory and Yale, and it's just kind of cool to see what professors are talking about. So I watched it. And, of course, the one I landed on was the man giving a one-hour lecture on, it was called UFOs and Racism.
Okay.
But it was really, really cool, Deb. He was comparing our prejudice to UFOs, and he was saying, you know, if you look at, like, the kind aliens are the Nords, and they happen to be blonde and blue-eyed, and the mean aliens are the Greys, and they happen to be, you know, not white. And I was just listening to your description with the unicorn, who in most descriptions is described as white.
Oh,
and I wonder if there's prejudice in there.
Of course there is.
Yeah.
Of course. Yes. Have you ever heard of a black unicorn?
No.
No, you have not.
And that's not fair.
Of course it isn't. So, yes, once again, that language of mythology also has that overtone in it that I don't think we like very much to talk about, but it's very real. Absolutely is.
Well, and then just to, you know, to wrap up on a hopeful note, I
yes,
would
please.
Like to point out that the gorilla was not discovered until 1847.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's true. So there's hope that we might really find some of these beings, right? That's what you're saying?
You never know.
You don't ever know. I'm hopeful. I am.
Me too.
I love it. Me too. I mean, would I not love to see a real Silky? Of course I would. So why would that be? But we're out of time. And so thank you all so much for listening. As you can tell, we've not covered all that we had hoped to be able to cover in this show, so there will be more on these mythical beings. If you want to send us comments about that, we'd love to hear your thoughts on it. In the meantime, we hope you have a great week. And Samantha, tell them what else to do.
Be the light, everyone. Take good care.
Okay, folks. Thanks, and take care. Bye-bye.